In the age of spin, deep fakes and public figures who are quite comfortable stretching the truth like perished elastic, it's getting harder and harder to get to the bottom of a story. And a number of fact-checking sites have popped up, including the aforementioned Snopes, a prominent American website credited as one of the first. Dan McGill previously worked at the Journal in Ireland, where he ran Fact Check, the nation's first dedicated fact-checking service, and he's also been deputy editor of the local France in Paris. He's now based in Pennsylvania and tells us that a storm is looming, not a political storm in this case, old son, an actual storm.
Hi, Philip. Good to talk to you.
So we are threatened by inclement weather.
Yeah, but I think that's an all-purpose statement.
Okay. Tell me a bit about the background of Snopes, which does such wonderful snooping. How did it all happen?
Yeah, well, the site started really as a hobby for our founder, David Mickelson, back in the early to mid-90s. He was, you know, particularly interested in urban legends, myths from the era of the sort of, I suppose you could say, the golden age of Hollywood, Disney, Walt Disney, and found like-minded people on sort of very, very primitive version of the internet at that time, and sort of set up a forum or a message board where people could share these stories and vignettes and anecdotes and, I suppose, fact-check them or argue about them or discuss them. And, you know, this hobby developed into something that is now, you know, I think one of the best known brands, I suppose, in debunking and urban legends and fact checking in the United States, certainly some 27 years later.
Dan, how is Snopes funded?
Primarily through advertising. Snopes is a business. It's not a non-profit organization. And we are primarily funded through advertising, but also through contributions that readers can make directly to us.
There's quite a few competitors these days, aren't there?
Mm. Sure, yeah, there are plenty of other websites, and there have been for many years plenty of other websites and organizations that do fact-checking, that do, I suppose there are some that maybe focus a little bit more on politics, and that has always been part of their raison d'etre. PolitiFact, for example, factcheck.org, some of the mainstays in the US, at least in terms of fact checking. Snopes has always taken, I suppose, a very broad approach. I suppose eclectic would be a nice way to describe it, the range of content and the range of topics and the range of questions that we attempt to answer on behalf of our loyal readers is quite broad, and it ranges from, you know, the deathly serious to things that, you know, any reasonable person would regard as frivolous.
Well, we're going to get into both shortly, but I must ask sure. you, the source of the name, I think it's a terrific name.
Yeah, well, it comes from the works of Faulkner. And I have to confess that it wasn't part of the entrance exam when I became a staff writer, but it's from the works of Faulkner, and I'm ashamed to say that's about all I can tell you about it at this moment.
I should have recognised it. Of course, Snopes is a reoccurring family in Faulkner's writings.
That's right.
Okay, now we've sorted that out. Let's look at this mixture of the earnest and the fun. Tell us about the recent occasion where you checked out whether or not Donald Trump, hallowed be his name, was wearing his trousers backwards.
Yeah, this was one of those really unusual stories. Not unusual in the sense of infrequent, but unusual nonetheless. These questions that are sort of remarkable to even have to answer, if you know what I mean. It was something that happened June 5th. Former President Trump gave a speech at a Republican Party convention in North Carolina. And this was sort of a high profile event because he hasn't made too many formal public appearances since he left the White House. And some snippets and video clips or some screenshots, that is still images from his speech or his appearance on the stage, were taken and spread widely on social media. And I don't know what the preferred nomenclature is in Australia, Philip, but his zipper or his fly was not clearly visible in the front of his trousers. Which obviously
we're multicultural in Australia, and both terms are acceptable.
Okay, good, very good. You know, so this became obviously he has for very obvious reasons he has been the object of ridicule and derision and all sorts of criticism over the last 5 years or so and further back indeed. So many people jumped on this immediately as an example on that he was maybe not in full control of his faculties or he had made a very embarrassing mistake. So it fell to my colleague Madison Dapkovich, who happened to be working a shift on that Sunday, the Sunday morning after the night before, and basically, realized that this was, something that people were were focusing on this particular Sunday morning, and that it was likely to be, the subject of a lot of coverage, and that we should check it out. And so, I mean, I think just one thing I would say about that story is obviously that, the subject matter might sort of obviously be frivolous from a certain point of view. Clearly,
I don't take that view. I think this is a matter of international significance.
Well, that's fair enough. You're joined in that view by many, many people. But I would say that the process or the methodology for checking it out was sort of pretty rigorous. And I think that that's clear from the story that Madison wrote. She watched the speech in its entirety and she checked other sources for sort of more high definition, better quality images of Trump and that particular part of his attire on the evening in question. And she found and gathered and examined closely the best available evidence that she could get. And she came to the conclusion that what had happened was the particular images or snippets or clips that had been, gone viral on social media, they happened to be of a kind of a low enough quality that it wasn't clearly visible that he was wearing a zipper in the front of his trousers. So the process is sort of similar in every fact check. Even if the subject matter can vary in its, in earnestness.
I think that's a wonderful outcome. I, in fact, am haunted by another image of the Donald, and that's the famous shot where he's climbing onto Air Force One with some toilet paper stuck on his shoe, but we won't submit that to Snopes for verification. But you must have been flat out during the Trump administration from the election on.
Yeah, well, I joined Snopes in May of 2017, so I wasn't working as a fact checker sort of in a US context during the 2016 election. But yeah, the last few years and the 2020 election in particular has been, I think for anybody involved in covering US politics, a very intense period. It's been very busy. The period, I would say, between Election Day in November and the January 6th riots at the US Capitol, was extraordinarily intense just in terms of the volume of misinformation and kind of weaponized disinformation that was being put out about on Election Day itself. It was sort of nonstop in terms of all sorts of alleged chicanery happening at the polls, the vast majority of which was, completely without basis. And we were there in real time, trying to, I suppose you could say, firefight that steady stream. And then over the subsequent months, with Trump obviously refusing to accept that he had been beaten fair and square by Joe Biden, culminating in the January 6th riots at the U.S. Capitol. That was, you know, an extremely busy, extremely intense period of deployment of, I would say, weaponized disinformation.
The Brogue of Dan McGill, and we're talking about Snopes. Now, let's do a segue from Trump's zipper to the revolving door. I love this story.
Oh, yeah. Now, this is a story that I think is sort of near and dear to my own heart. This is the story of Theophilus Van Cannell, the much maligned and only very recently vindicated Theophilus Van Cannell. So Theophilus Van Cannell was an inventor, a little bit of a, I don't know what you might call him, a bit of a Victorian eccentric in the US, and an inventor who has long been credited with inventing the revolving door. Now, in the last decade or so, it has sort of entered, you know, it has entered the history books, or it has entered the public psyche as a matter of historical record that Van Cannell invented the revolving door because he so despised the norms of chivalry and so despised having to hold open doors for women so that they could walk ahead of him into buildings, and that this was you know, the motivating animus for him in inventing some way that would never have to be an issue for him anymore. And you know, so it's a remarkable story. You know, I think it's a good example maybe of what I would call a type of sort of archaeology that we do at Snopes, and many other researchers and fact checkers do as well. But sort of looking through layers and layers of evidence, looking through layers and layers of sources, and tracking things down to their very, very origins. And I suppose that the research for that particular article took me in two interesting directions. The first was I lived near Washington, D.C. at the time, so took a trip to the Library of Congress and found a rare, maybe even a once-off biography of Van Cannell, which I think had been put together by some of his family members based on his journals and his diary entries and so on. And what it revealed, the question here is, you know, first of all, is there any evidence that this man held these views towards women, or that he was against chivalry or misogynistic in any sort of particular way? And then secondly, you know, can we establish what his motivation was in actually inventing, you know, the revolving door? And in looking through his biography and his diaries, it revealed quite the opposite. This was a man who was quite conventional in many ways, a little bit eccentric, quite sort of sober and straight-laced in a particular way that we might find amusing in this day and age, but also somebody who very clearly understood the norms and rules of etiquette and chivalry and courting. There are some nice tender moments in his diaries where he's courting his future wife, and you know, noting the time at which they went their separate ways after visiting the theatre together, and so on. So it's pretty clear that he has a firm sense of chivalry and a firm obedience to those rules. And then the second thing was to track down where this specific rumour and the specific claim about, you know, that this is why he invented the revolving door. It turns out that the furthest back I could take this was a blog entry in, I think, 2008. This was an art history blog by someone interested and enthusiast in New York City. And it turned out that a year or 18 months later, this particular person had found my email to them sort of languishing in their spam inbox or their spam folder, and eventually got around to emailing me back and confirmed, you know, that this was just a joke. And I think it's interesting to note what they said to me, this blogger, was, when I wrote the piece, I assumed that the absurdity of the idea would be self-evident. Alas, that old chestnut about assumptions proved its inherent wisdom yet again. And I think there's a big lesson in that for anyone who's in the business of trying to sift through information and historical sources.
Dan, over the decades, I've written some absurd things in my newspaper columns. impossible, and they've been taken dead seriously, even by academics, so ironies are often lost. And it let the record show, of course, that revolving doors have now become such a powerful metaphor. We have a revolving door arrangement for our prime ministers. They come in one side and out the next, and we have another one. It's magical. Now, let's move on to another story. A 130-year-old scandal in which the heir of Jameson Whiskey was accused of buying a slave girl.
Yeah, this is, Philip, this is a really horrible story. I mean, I think it is, you know, fair to give listeners fair warning that they're, you know, I'm not going to go into any graphic detail, but you know, it's not a pleasant topic. But it is something that has, this anecdote, this story has come about or come up in various different forms over the last 10, 15 years and has sort of seen a resurgence in the era of social media. The story here is about James Sligo Jemison, who was the grandson of the famous creator of the Irish whiskey. And, you know, the short version of the story is that he was involved in a colonial expedition to Africa in the late 1880s, and that he, for a very low price indeed, bought an African slave girl of 11 years old or so, in order that he might see the practice of cannibalism, so that he was living out some sort of dark desire to, you know, witness firsthand this practice and this phenomenon that he had heard so much about. The long and the short of it is essentially that, you know, this is something that we reached a rating of mixture on it. So that is to say that there is an element of truth in this. Jemison himself, in his own diaries, did admit that he attended, you know, I believe a sort of a campfire in what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. This would have been in 1888. And that he did indeed witness this absolutely horrifying scene. And he described it himself as the most horrible scene I ever witnessed in my life. But he firmly denied that he had deliberately or knowingly sort of brought this about. His explanation for what happened was that he had been sitting around telling stories and sharing stories, and he had been sort of poking fun at some of the men that were with him, saying, you know, surely these cannibalism stories can't be true. You know, there's no way that anybody could actually, you know, could live in this way or could carry out practices such as this. And I think a man who was one of his fellow travelers said, well, if you give me something, I'll show you what's true. And what he ended up giving him, Jemison ended up giving him, was so the accounts share this detail, that it was 6 handkerchiefs that he handed over to this other man. Now, what Jemison said was that he never thought that they would actually go through with it. He thought he was being swindled, and he was sort of being a willing participant in that and going along with the ruse. But what you know, what transpired was very real and you know, absolutely horrifying, the accounts of it.
Can we move on to a more cheerful story? And that's the origins of OMG. Stands, of course, for Oh My God in social media.
Yeah, this is a really interesting little story. This is the type of thing that, for me, it's a good example of these stories and these memes, these social media posts that pop up that you know, that claim to contain these little factoids and little tidbits of historical trivia. Very often, you'll take a look at them, and your instinct and your, you know, all of your experience and your knowledge of these and your familiarity with these types of posts will immediately lead any reasonable person to assume that OMG, and the use of OMG as a shortened version of Oh My God, is clearly something that emerged from youth culture or texting culture, SMS or online chat culture, you know, in perhaps at most 20 years ago. And this story is an example of where, you know, all of your assumptions and going into a story can be completely flipped on their head. It turns out that, in fact, the first known or documented use of OMG in that context and in that sense was in a letter that was actually written to Winston Churchill, of all people. And it was written in 1917. And it was written by Lord Fisher, John Arbuthnot, Fisher, who was a retired British naval admiral. And it was discovered by Ben Zimmer, who's a linguist and a researcher, and made this remarkable discovery in a letter that was sent in September 1917.
So he writes the letter complaining about Britain's naval strategy in World War One. So how does OMG happen?
So it's a kind of a play on words. I think he's punning a little bit because obviously the initialisms that are involved in the orders of knighthood. I'm an Irishman, so I'm not an expert on this particular subject. but yeah, I think he is being playful there.
I think it would sound terrific after, you know, CMG or whatever, OMG. I'd like one of those.
It might be confusing, though, in this day and age, but I'm sure it's worth a try.
So it's born in this correspondence to Winston Spencer Churchill. When did it catch on?
Well, I think that the Oxford English Dictionary first added an entry in March 2011. So it is something that, you know, at that point, it was in fairly wide usage. And I think that the assumption of many people would be that that's around the time, you know, that it first became sort of accepted. And obviously, if the Oxford English Dictionary is accepting, then it's in wide usage at that point. But I think part of the process of ratifying and words and phrases and that these researchers and lexicographers go through is to find the first known usage. And so ensued this this journey that we went on to discover the original, very surprising origins.
Now, I don't want to snoop into Snopes, into your, you know, private prognostications, but what are you working on at the moment?
We're trying to just continue doing what we're doing and what we've been doing for the last number of years, and certainly for the last 5 years. It's difficult. We don't have as many people as we would like to have. But from my own point of view, I've worked on a couple of interesting things recently. I don't know if you're familiar with the movie franchise of The Conjuring. This was a particularly interesting piece of research and a particularly interesting interview. The Conjuring is a horror movie franchise that involves all sorts of possessions and exorcism and all kinds of things. And the most recent movie that may currently be in cinemas in Australia, I'm not sure, revolves around the Glatzel family in Connecticut. And, a little bit of research showed me that there was an odd brother out within that family who is not featured in the movie and firmly rejects all supernatural explanations for what happened in his family. So I tracked him down and interviewed him, and he gave me some very interesting insights into how his family history had been portrayed in that particular film. So that might be something that listeners would be interested in.
Now, the message from Snopes is, in effect, that all readers, all listeners, should have healthy skepticism about what they're reading and listening to.
Absolutely, yes. And I think this is something that I suspect, you know, your listeners will be familiar with already. I mean, this, you know, it's obviously vital to be informed. It's vital to have a healthy skepticism about what you're hearing and what you're reading. I would say, though, to counterbalance that it's also important to be open-minded. I think that as we've just sort of discussed with the first use of OMG, obviously something that's very surprising, and all of your knowledge and your experience would tell you differently. And if you didn't read the story, you wouldn't know that the reality was otherwise. So I think it's important for people to obviously be skeptical, to ask themselves what the original source is of what, to check what their source's source is, and then check what their source's sources are. And track down that. Obviously, that's, you know, a lot of people don't have time to do that, and that's why, you know, there are people like myself who do these things for a living.
You're fact-checking and having fun, we are fascinated by your efforts, and I thank you very much, Dan, for coming on the program. The voice of Dan McGill from the Snoopers at Snoops.